You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and today I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with two gentlemen and a woman, a lady. I guess if it's two gentlemen, it's a lady. And they are, let me just introduce them briefly. They are Ilarion Mikuliev, and I'll tell you a little something about him in a moment. George Pletnikov. Did I get that right, George?
You did. Good. Thank you.
Good. And and Shay Sloan Clark. I met Shay when she was Shay Sloan, and now she is Shay Sloan Clark. And so welcome, everybody, and thank you. Thank you all three for giving up some time and being here. And so let me just say briefly what I know, and then I'm going to ask you guys to fill in. Ilarion Kuyuk Mikuliev.
It's almost right. You have the X at the end is a soft guttural sound at the back of your neck, back of your throat. So
Kuyuk.
Kuyuk.
Kuyuk. Kuyuk. Mikuliev. Ilarion, also known as Larry, but I'd probably always call him Ilarion, is the founder of the Global Center for Indigenous Leadership and Lifeways. And Ilarion is a visionary behind the Wisdom Weavers of the World, which we will speak about, the project founder and the ongoing key speaker. Raised in a traditional Onangan, did I get that right? Onangan way, you might have heard them by the name that was given to them by the conqueror colonizers, the Aleut or Aleut, depending upon who was saying it. Ilarion received his Onangan name, Kuyuk. I think I got it right. At age 4, which is another thing I'm hoping to speak about. The name is given to one person in each lifetime amongst his people. Kuyuk means an arm extending out from the body, a carrier of ancient knowledge into modern times, a messenger. Today, he is living the legacy of his name. George Pletnikov was born and raised on St. George Island in Alaska. And I don't have much here about you, George. George, are you also Onangan?
I am.
You also, yeah. You are Onangan, but you have this other piece of your history. Well, I hope we all speak about. You were a priest, an Orthodox priest for a number of years. And the other things I have is that I know about you is you have a degree in biology. So,
yeah.
And I don't know if you are still being a priest now. We'll find out in a moment. Let me just introduce Shay for a second. And Shay, you didn't send me your bio. So I will tell you, I know Shay because of her work in a nonprofit that is no more, called the Ojai Foundation, which was in Ojai, California. We won't speak much about that because it's in the past. And currently, Shay is the interim executive director, is that true, of Wisdom Weavers of the World. And she can say a little bit about what that's about. So let's just get right to that piece. So Alarian, I'm gonna ask you, and really feel free, everybody feel free to jump in and, you know, participate. But what is the Wisdom Weavers of the world, and why is the Wisdom Weavers of the world, and what is it about, and why did it get started, whether you started it or not?
Okay, Angwan. I said, hello, my other self, which is the way we greet each other amongst the Unungan people. And I said, the morning tastes good. That's another way we greet each other every day. And I said that I am Unungan, which is Aleut. We don't use that word because it's a word given to us by our former oppressors. We use Unungan. And I said my traditional name is Kuya. I received that name when I was 4 years old by the last Kuya that was left alive amongst my people, Sergei Savora. And he gave me his name. And so we called each other Kuya. Now, the Wisdom Weavers is something that, you know, I was at a meeting at the Wild Foundation, and we're talking about what environmental groups do and all that kind of stuff. And I realized that, you know, we for 30 years, we have more or over 30 years, we have more environmental organizations around the world than ever before, than 30 years ago. And yet still the life support systems of Mother Earth is coming to the edge. And I wondered why and what I could do about it. And I thought, well, how about bringing elders from all over the world together? And so we did in Kauai in 2017. And we only asked the elders two questions. One, what is the state of the world as we see it now? And two, what must we be doing now? And so we did ceremonies in the morning every day from the different traditions that were there, and then talked during the day. And the results of which are encapsulized in a film that we produced from this gathering. And it was launched by Reuters worldwide in 2020 during Earth Day. And it was interpreted into 15 different languages. And we had 80,000 people that viewed that film the first day. So it was a good launch. And that film contains the messages from the elders for the world. And that's on our website, www.wisdomweavers.world. Yeah.
I'll make sure, by the way, I'll make sure I put that, all that information about Wisdom Weavers in the link and the film posted so that people can access it and see where it is. But can I ask? Okay, but why now? Right? I mean, so there's all these, why are you not simply, and I don't mean that in a bad way, another environmental organization? What's different?
Well, what's different is that we're not an organization. We have a team of people who work with the Wisdom Weavers to connect elders around the world and to get our messages out on various media. So we've been doing like two gatherings on Zoom a week for the last 3 years all over the world. And so we're getting the messages of the elders to the world out. And why now is that the elders feel like it's not a question about whether or not Mother Earth is going to survive. She survived for billions of years, and she's going to survive for billions more. It's a question about whether or not we humans are going to survive. And they feel like we don't have very much time left. We've got to act now.
Yeah, thank you. And do the Wisdom Weavers or do other organizations approach you? Do some of these environmental organizations want to, I don't know how to say it, to work with you or to get something from you? Or
no, not environmental organizations. We get spiritual people, spiritual organizations, spiritually based organizations, and people from around the world that contact us.
So this is a question. So the message, your message is not focused necessarily on the environment, but something else. So could you say something about, and you know, you guys can fight about who's saying it. about what that message is.
Yeah.
Sure. I have if you don't mind, Larry, I have a thought on that. Just to mention that I worked with Greenpeace for about 12 years. Hmm. They recruited me and I worked here in Alaska and primarily with tribal communities. And when I talk about tribal communities, it's the villages. We have about 229 tribes in Alaska. And many of them I worked with trying, and this is the point that I wanted to make on your question, and that is that I can go to school and learn about biology. And primarily what I'm learning about biology comes from understandings assembled by the Western culture, which is a culture that is, you know, radically different than indigenous people's cultures. So when you ask the question that, so you're really not an environmental organization, it kind of popped up in my head that what we have learned has come from the experiences of our ancestors and what they learned and what they passed on to us. Now, our responsibility as, I don't know if I want to call myself a messenger of their knowledge, is to continue to use that knowledge to create an understanding about how we perceive and learned about how creation and our survival are dependent upon what our ancestors gave to us. It isn't it isn't a formal education. It isn't anything that we can learn from books, but it is something that they gathered together. You could imagine just about the Yunungan people who lived out on the Aleutian Islands here in Alaska and survived for, as far as we understand, more than 10,000 years living there. And so when we gather with other indigenous tribes and groups, we're sharing our experiences and what we've learned from our ancestors together. We're not sharing theories or we're not sharing hypotheses, if that's if that's a good word. Or
that's a lot of hypotheses.
A lot of hypotheses. And that what we learned that's very different than Western cultural ways, I think, is that it is intricately tied with our spirituality. It isn't sort of like science in that regard that Western cultures would think of, but it is tied closely to our spirituality.
So you are underlining and emphasizing that difference between both what you know about the experience of the planet or of the Earth and the things that are on it, and what the West knows, not just what they know, but how they know. And I guess, you know, is it shareable? Can people from the West understand it? From people who are immersed and grow up in a culture that is, as you speak about it, in some ways very, very different, very foreign. Can the average Westerner relate to it, understand it? Is there something about it that bridges the cultural divide?
Well, David, that's a central question. And what the elders from all over the world are unanimous about this. What we need to do now is change our consciousness from the mind to the heart.
Well, yeah, and when you say we, you're not talking about just indigenous people. You're talking about everybody.
Yeah, everybody.
Got it.
The mind is now the consciousness that is centered around the world, and then we look at it as the seat of intelligence. But what I'm talking about is I don't know what you would call it, but it's more than the knowledge that is contained in the mind. And the mind is the reason, according to these elders, that that talks to us rather than our hearts talking to us. And that we can't tell the difference between the mind talking and the heart talking, because the mind is very clever. It makes you think that it's your heart talking when it may not be. Mm-hmm. And that this consciousness is the reason, according to these elders, the core reason why we have all the ills in the world. We have war, we have the gross violation of women, the refugees, the political corruption, the deforestation, the droughts and famine, floods. All of these things are caused, were created by humans. And that that we cannot just simply pray to a God that's like a Santa Claus God that says, please give me this, please give me that. That we need to take responsibility for our actions as human beings, and we must act now to change this consciousness. The heart is a place that I feel is our main connection with the divine, and that it contains peace and harmony and justice and patience and love and all these things that your heart is, that and your heart never tells you anything that is what is being told to people now through the mind, which is disconnected. And that the elders are saying that the disconnection that we are facing is that we have disconnected from our hearts. And when we disconnect from our hearts, it's easy to disconnect from anybody else, for mm-hmm. everybody else. And that including Mother Earth, ultimately. And so this connection needs to be healed. So yes, we're hearing, in all the group gatherings that we've done on Zoom in the last 3 years, we can see that there are millions of people that are starting to change from the mind to the heart.
So you reminded me of, excuse me, years ago I was working with a bunch of indigenous people from northern New York, New York State. And there was this one wonderful, wonderful guy, John Mohawk, since passed away. And I remember the first time I was speaking with him, and he said, we have to use, it was like this, we have to use our best minds. We must use our best minds. And I, at some point when I was more comfortable with him, I said, what do you, why, what is this? and it was exactly that message. Well, his was, you know, that the mind, the best mind, there's, yes, we can, sir, there's all sorts of things that happen in our brain, in our mind, and that's terrific. And then there's all sorts of things in our feelings and emotions, but what it, unless we can pull those two things together and use our best mind, it's when those two things come together. And I'm wondering if as you gather, as all of the I'm assuming they're the leaders, but maybe not, the people from these various indigenous groups come together. So they are in all sorts of ways far apart, but right, I mean, they have different traditions and they have different costume, they have different dances and songs, and but is there a through line? Is there a commonality? Is there, like, do you feel like you walked into a place where you know, people are all speaking different languages and it's hard to understand what the hell they're talking about? And I don't actually mean language when I say that, but, or do you feel like you've walked into like a you know, long lost family that just got together? It's like they discovered, oh wait, you're like me. So I'm curious about how that works, because, you know, in we all know, in the Western world, you travel to enough places, and I mean, even in the United States, right? You travel. I lived in California. I now live in Wyoming, and sure, there are some commonality, but there's also a lot of bridging to be done. And I'm wondering about that.
Yeah, maybe I can answer, and then George and Shay, please wade in. You know, I've gone to many places around the world invited by indigenous people. I've gone to Patagonia to be with the Mapuche. I've been to Tarahumaras in northwestern Mexico. I've been to many, many different tribes. And, you know, I'm invited to participate in their ceremonies. And when I do that, I don't know the language and I don't know the customs, but it's all very familiar because we come from the same place of spirituality that George talked about. And, you know, I'm always welcome. Now, when I went down to Patagonia with the Mapuche people, they invited me to the ceremony that was led by the oldest woman in the world at that time. She was 126 years old, as far as people knew, because that's the first time and the last time that they found her age. She could have been older, and she was blind, and she only spoke her own language. And so, you know, all I could do was hold her hands and cry. I just felt like this tremendous wisdom and things that she has gone through. But this ceremony, you know, I met seven spiritual leaders from the Quechua and Aymara people that came down by horseback for 2 weeks. Just to see me. And I said, wow, this must be really important. When we got to the ceremonial grounds there, sure enough, those seven were standing there waiting for me. And they wanted to know what my name was and how I got the name and what it meant. So I told them. And they said, they got together and they came back excited and said, yeah, we have the same name. And it's given in exactly the same way. And it means exactly the same thing. This confirmed to them that that they were the go-betweens for our people and the people in Patagonia. Now our people were sea people, and they said that the people, our people, came down by our kayaks, our ikyaks, we call it, and they showed me a picture of a member of the tribe, and it was, I tell you, I could have, there would have been a twin on St. Paul Island for this guy that they took a picture of. And so they were go-betweens for our people and theirs, and for all of South America. And what we did was exchange various things, one of which we got from the Mapuche, were healing song and healing herbs and from South America. That's what we got before the entire Turtle Island, which is the U.S. U.S., Mexico, Central America, and South America. We used to have sophisticated exchange and trading protocol that existed during that time. And now some of the people are resurrecting this way. But yes, when we go to somebody's place, we feel it. We know what they're doing, but can't understand the language. Mm-hmm. George Shea?
Well,
sorry, being very quiet.
just to answer your introductory question about me and my priesthood. First of all, I am an alcoholic, and I'm recovering and have been for at least a decade. But I was ordained into the priesthood. I no longer serve or function as a priest, but that the bishop who ordained me said that, you know, you are a priest forever, as the holy book says, after the order of Melchizedek. And in that capacity, my goal somehow was to figure out, and I'm still trying to do that, our Unungan people before 200 years ago. 200 years ago was our invasion, or how do they call that? You know, people, they come in and they're colonizing. And that was the colonizing stuff. So as Unungan, we've been Christian for only 200 years, and that's like, you're not even, boy, you know, we're just infants in terms of having any relationship and understanding of holiness and God in the Christian understanding. So how my thing is, how was our relationship with the Creator prior to being Christianized? And I think maybe that got me into some political trouble with the leaders, or some leaders of the church, because as my bishop who ordained me once told me, Father George, you're always talking about the Aleut. He was of Russian descent and migrated to America during the Second World War. So he had a very strong accent yet. And I said, yes, because that's who I am. And my question, at least in my mind, is what is the relationship between the Creator and the Unungan people before we were Christianized? And I have to tell you, seeking an answer to that is a very exciting experience.
Why? Tell me more.
Because I understand that my parents or my family, excuse me, or my ancestors and my ancestors are not gone. They are still praying. They are still communicating with us. They are still living with us. If we recognize and allow them to. It reminds me a little bit of what my Kuma said. My Kuma, I call him Kuma because he's the godfather of our oldest daughter. And we have a special relationship in that regard, Larry and I. I always go back to that, knowing it is one of the reasons why I love him so much. But I've debated a lot of things with Larry with my Kuma for, I don't know, a long, long, long time. We just get into it.
You should sell tickets.
What I talked about with him is, I hear him say my heart as a special place that offers clarity in our lives and clarity of direction. But the heart is also the home of a hell of a lot of evil. Lots of evil. If you think about how just the example of the Holocaust, other examples of, last year I read the Arctic Mirrors, this incredible book about migration from essentially Sweden over to the Bering Sea and how the indigenous people were treated. And how our people, based upon the history of the information in that book, how our people were treated. We had our own genocide and our own Holocaust when the colonizers, that's too nice of a word, but when they came over to Alaska. So, it takes patience and quiet silence to listen not only to the not only in my condition, my situation, not only to the Holy Spirit, Jesus Christ and the Trinity, but to our ancestors. And I'm not trying to say anything like I have a special telephone or a Zoom camera or anything like this with them. I don't.
Well, that would have made you really popular if you did.
That would make me really crazy. But it's kind of like that.
Uh-huh.
You listen.
Yeah.
You listen to, you get amazing how people come to you, whether they come to you spiritually or mentally. When you think about them and think about what they offered to you and how that enables you to find and seek possible solutions.
Mm.
One of the things that I got in trouble with Greenpeace, after a while, I went to conferences and they like to do that, conferences. And so obviously I had to train and learn them and learn their philosophy and learn their probable solutions to overfishing in the Bering Sea, for example. And what do we do about that? And one of the things that I ask him is, or ask them is, you bring a lot of people from Europe to work here in the United States on environmental issues, Christianized, and how that happened and how that worked. And so that's kind of, you yeah. know, and that was a tie to my priesthood.
Yeah. I'm sorry to stop you. I just want to make I want to make sure, Shay, I want to give you a chance to say something. If you're called to, you don't have to, but yeah. Are you there? You are.
I'm here. I'm in the tall grass.
I see that.
Corn. Are you in corn?
Nope. Tall grass. The wee people. I am Irish. My mother is first generation American, and my ancestors come from Europe on a small island that is called Ireland. And from my perspective, for my listening, I love your question, George, about your ancestors' relationship to creation prior to Christianization. And I feel like I share the question of my own ancestors and, you know, before, who were we before the Crusades, and who were we before the burning of the women and the healers of former times, and who were we before these perpetuated traumas, and who are we now, and how do we reconcile the capacity, you know, Larry, in your words, of living from the heart and the purity that can come from that space, and then the traumatic harms that are lodged in our memory and that we repeat, you know, what we've endured, we give unto others. And so my role or my work here with these Valerian and George, these beautiful men, and the other elders in the council, is to support their efforts with their own peoples. And so that's my role. I'm working as the executive director, and I kind of do whatever's needed to help them be able to stay focused on their own work without the entanglements of the bureaucracy and the organizational requirements getting in the way, which, as we know, are superimposed on other ways of being. So I hold that role here. And then I also do my own work related to ancestors and ancestry and working in other spaces where there are different elements. Then I will never center that. Like, I wouldn't interject in this Zoom call to say, well, let's talk about all the European, although I'm willing to, but there are other spaces where whiteness and the history and legacy and impacts of that is so often ignored. And we jump instead to solutions or saying things like, this isn't a political space, so don't bring up those issues. Where I feel and appreciate that a deeper healing or a deeper connection is possible when we can look at and be with the kaleidoscopic truth or impacts of these intersections. And so, you know, I'm here and I'm listening and happy to speak and also happy to not. And yeah, thank you for the invitation and the chance to be here with all three of you.
Yeah.
Yeah, David. No,
please. Yeah, please.
What George said is very true. And I hope that people take that to heart. You know, we had our, Unangan people had our own Holocaust, where 80% of our population was wiped out in 50 years. That's quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we we have a remarkable group of people that we come from. You know, like the Jews, we had our Holocaust. Like the Japanese Americans, we were interned in Southeast Alaska, where we were basically prisoners, where 10% of our elders and young people died because at the hands of the U.S. government because of the way they treated us. We had no health facilities. We had every kind of disease, impetigo, measles, smallpox, tuberculosis, all of these things that were in the camp. My grandmother is buried in Southeast Alaska, who died during that time. Like the Black Americans, we were enslaved, and we didn't achieve our political independence until 1966. But yet we're still here after 10,000 years because of the inspiration of our people and the bravery and courage that they had to be able to live to this day. And this is the legacy that we carry that is so important now. And if it wasn't for my people, I wouldn't have had the intelligence to call together elders. So I give them a great deal of credit. And we as human beings, every tradition that I've been to always prays and does ceremony for everybody in the world, not just their people. And they still do this to this day. They're praying for that our people will wake up to what we need to do now.
Can we figure out how to recover the connection? It's not even a connection, the obvious, like, you know, you cut me, I bleed, I cut you, you bleed, right? I mean, it's like there's so many ways in which we are the same. There's so many ways in which we are the same. We're fragile, much more fragile than so many other creatures. You know, we certainly don't know everything, but there's so many ways. And I think it's really important to try to wrestle with the challenges of our histories and our terrible histories, the terrible histories of interaction between whatever counts as the West and indigenous people. And I guess, you know, there's one of the things that's floating out there for me is, you know, the people you live with, the people you live among, right? I mean, your people, the Yurungan, or I know I'm saying it wrong. I don't mean uniformity like everybody's brainwashed. I mean, is there a widespread sort of embrace of traditional ways, or do you meet resistance among your own people? And how do you wrestle with that? Or do you?
George, why don't you start off?
Our youngest son, Junior, I didn't name him Junior. My wife named him Junior. He just got married a year ago. He lives out at St. Paul Island. And he has a little girl who, by the way, is... Anyway, so they came and stayed with us for these last 2 weeks. Largely just to be with us for our wedding anniversary. We celebrated our 50th anniversary a few days ago.
Happy anniversary.
And so thank you. And so they wanted to be with us to do that. And he teaches the Unungan Tunu, the Yunnan language. He teaches the Yunnan language on St. Paul, which is very, very challenging to him, because he struggles with validity. And is this something that is going to have long-lasting use or importance or whatever else term you want to throw at that? And he struggles with that. And we spoke about it briefly, he and I, and in relationship to our Yunnan nation. One of the things that we did not and do not have is a written history or a written language as Yunnan people. And so most of what we may know about our history is either told by some elders who, well, okay, they're going back 20 years. Oh, okay, they're going back 50 years. And it's very, you know, very narrow of time in the past and not much to depend upon in terms of, okay, well, then how about 500 years ago? Well, yeah, no, you know. One of the things that my son and I talked about was not knowing who we are. That we roam around on these really very difficult islands and environment, storms, rain, monsoons, all kinds of stuff. That's, and fog. And it's not very comfortable, but it's our home, and yeah, many of us love it. But we're roaming, trying to decide, or at least have an understanding of who we are. Even to this day, most of the people will not call themselves Yunnan. They call themselves Aleut. And here's a very interesting brief story on that. The bishop of the Orthodox Church went to St. George Island last May to celebrate the feast day of the patron saint of that island, St. George. And in one of his interactions with the community, he said, yeah, you know, the St. George Yunnan Orthodox Church, instead of saying, and I've been sort of lobbying about this or talking about it for, I don't know, 20 years, ever since I was admonished by my bishop, you're always talking about Aleut, is that it should be the St. George Yunnan Orthodox Church. We ought to have a relationship with that. It should be ours. It should be our church, not the St. George Russian Orthodox Church or the Holy Ascension Russian Orthodox Cathedral, but struggling to find out what it is that ties us to where we live, who we are, and our ancestry. And because we don't have that relationship, you could understand that a lot of, we were talking about how evil there much, how much evil there is in the heart. That, and of course in the mind, but that other problems befall us. Depression comes, suicide comes. So it's like everybody else's communities all over the world. But drug problems come, alcoholisms come, And now we have, you know, I have what, one of these things, you know, oh, hi, my baby. Yeah, wait, I have to answer. Okay, what were you saying? Oh, okay, well, wait, I got a very important message from Shay. I have to answer it now, you know.
Oh, you're doing theater. I thought you were really doing
that. Not picking on Shay as an example. But we have so many, many very nice distractions that what is important to knowing who we are, well, that's in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it has no value.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as you said, we have all kinds of these similarities. Spiritually, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us are Episcopalian in the Christian church, or some of us are Buddhists or whatever else. And we get an attachment to the ancestors and our people by spirituality in having that relationship. So like everybody else, we struggle, and our young people struggle. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to keep my son going is a struggle. You know, Dad, I don't know what to do. I know I need to do this. I want to do this. I see the value of it. I understand. But I don't know what to do now. Should I just move? Should I just move down to our traditional homeland?
You know, George Jr. is doing one of the most important pieces of work that could be done amongst our people. And so I hope he decides to stay on St. Paul, because he's invaluable for many, many reasons. Now, my name, Kuyah, is not a name that anybody else remembers. They don't know or refuse to know or whatever that I was given the gift at 4 years old.
Say that again, because you broke. Say that again, because you broke up when you said you were given that name when you were 4 years old. Yeah.
Okay. And by the last Kuyuk that was left alive, Sergei Suvorov, and Sergei Suvorov was from a different island, and he knew that his time was coming to an end, and he had to find the next Kuyuk. And so he found me on St. Paul Island. I was born and raised in a way that I remember things that the written books don't have, that most of the elders have forgotten. And it's very hard, because people say, oh yeah, sure, you want to be this, want to be that. And I don't want to be the Kuya. I don't want to be. It's very difficult. It's very hard because the things that have to go through as a Kuya is, you know, it's like walking a fine line. It's easy to slip up on one side or the other. And when you do, I immediately get the responses back to me immediately. And so I have to be very careful in what I think and what I know and what I say. And George talks about silence. Silence is absolutely necessary for this connection to God. We call this the great spirit that lives in all things. And that this silence is not, it's silencing the mind, and so that you can feel clearly what your heart is telling you. And this is the message that we want to give to everybody, that you've got to be able to be in that silence. I mean, even all the villages in Alaska, 229 villages in Alaska, the most number of tribes in North America, in a single place. They, you know, they are doing things without realizing the why they're doing it. And that is that we talk more slowly. You hear George talking very slow. We move slower. We act slower. What the people in the village are doing are slowing down enough to be able to hear Mother Earth. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.